4-0-9-7167, in re Interstate 20 Incorporated litigation, Monica Bellison and others similarly situated at all appellants versus Raven Black Company LLC. Ms. McClellan for appellants, Ms. Martinez for appellees.
There you are.
That's just perfect.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael McClellan, and I'm appearing on behalf of the various appellants in this case. And if I may, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case is about a Ponzi scheme.
Counsel, may I had a feeling you were going to start with that phrase. May I ask you a question? With respect to the financial reports, we're talking about a balance sheet and a P&L, basically?
Yes, basically, Your Honor, I believe so.
Is it fair to say that if there was a Ponzi scheme, the P&L has to be false?
I believe it was false in this instance.
Yeah, no, it has to be with a Ponzi
scheme. Yeah, I think
scheme.
So. I mean, almost certainly, yes.
Yeah, because in a Ponzi scheme, you're taking a contribution of capital and treating it as income.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So there's no question that the financial documents which the appellees certified were false, and that falsity reflected the Ponzi scheme.
There's certainly no dispute that those were in fact false, Your Honor.
So there's a misrepresentation.
There is a misrepresentation, Your Honor, and we've never contended otherwise.
Let me give you another hypothetical. Suppose the balance sheet describes $1 million of assets in cash. And in fact, the CEO of the company has stolen $500,000 and he's got it in his safe. Is it a omission for the accounting firm in this hypothetical to have not stated that the CEO stole half the money if it certified that the balance sheet was correct, there was $1 million in cash?
It would be an omission. It would certainly be an omission, Your Honor. I think in that instance, you would then go through the case-specific analysis that...
But then I'm troubled by the argument which the other side has made, is that in under those circumstances, every misrepresentation case becomes an omission case, because there's always some facts, some gloss on a misrepresentation, greater specificity as to the nature of the misrepresentation. Isn't that true?
It's not, Your Honor, and let me explain why this case is a little bit different than your hypothetical.
But you said in my hypothetical that would be an omission.
Well, Your Honor, I said it would be a mission, but I didn't say that it would be an omission that would necessarily lead to the affiliated presumption of reliance.
Would it or would it not?
Without more facts, Your Honor, I believe that it probably would not, and the reason for that is because the fraud there would be confined merely to an overstatement of assets. The difference here is that what was ultimately concealed here was the Interbank was not a viable entity without this fraud, without this scheme. And the risk that ultimately manifested...
Wouldn't that be, if I were looking at the P&L, it would be obvious to me, if the P&L was accurate, it would show the Ponzi scheme.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
If the P&L was accurately set forth, it would show a Ponzi scheme or something quite similar.
It would certainly show that something was wrong, Your Honor, but what I don't believe it would show is that it was necessary to maintain this scheme in order for the business itself to be a sustainable entity. What ultimately caused
the moment you see that the profit is misstated, flatly misstated, that the bells go off. Does it matter whether it's a Ponzi scheme or whether the CEO stole the money?
Well, again, what I think the difference is that a CEO stealing $500,000 wouldn't necessarily strike at the heart of the business. What the difference is...
It sure is.
Well, I guess it depends on how much assets the business has. That was a dramatic overstatement. I apologize. But, again, what we allege was concealed here was that the business itself was not a viable business and that it was only able to maintain the appearance of viability by going through and calling it, by engaging in this Ponzi scheme practice, Your Honor. And that's what really is the heart of our case, is that the ultimate risk that manifested itself and caused the plaintiff's harm was not the misstatements on the balance sheets. It was the fact that the business itself was unsustainable because it was a Ponzi scheme. And I think it's very difficult to say that the heart of this case is not that scheme, Your Honor. And what Affiliated Ute ultimately requires us to do is to really parse apart the case itself and look really at what the heart of it is. And in this instance, it's very, very difficult to say that the case doesn't center around the risk that ultimately manifested itself, which would be the unsustainability of the interbank funds as an ongoing enterprise. And what concerned me about the district court's analysis was that the primary reason that it held that we were not entitled to a presumption of reliance was because Radin just offered positive statements. And I did not believe that that was consistent with the analysis set forth in Affiliated Ute, which obligates the courts to go through a case-specific determination and analyze whether the omissions or the misrepresentations were paramount. And in this instance, for the reasons I just said, the sustainability of the business and the Ponzi scheme itself were the paramount allegations in the case. And Radin's failure, the appellee's failure to outline those omissions, or its failure to disclose that scheme itself, was what caused the plaintiff's loss and what ultimately should give rise to a presumption of reliance in this case. And what the lower court did make a passing observation, as I'm sure you realize, that Radin's positive statements dwarf any omissions. But again, I believe that the centrality of the scheme to this case would mean that those misrepresentations would be, in fact, subordinate to the omissions themselves. And so we've cited a number of cases in our brief applying the presumption in similar circumstances, and I believe some of those go to the question that you were just asking, Your Honor. And one of them was the Aiken case, which is a Fifth Circuit case from 1992. And that's an instance where an accounting firm spoke partially but incompletely about a firm that in large part was only sustainable because of its ability to make continuing offerings and fund earlier payments through those offerings, or that was the underlying scheme of the business. And the other cases that we cite on pages 15 and 16 of our brief, which are class certification opinions.
Those are the district court opinions?
Those are district court opinions, Your Honor.
The district court, I didn't see a circuit court yet that has held that, quote, a Ponzi scheme falls within the Supreme Court's presumption of reliance.
Well, Aiken, I believe, is the closest one that comes to saying that, Your Honor, and I understand there were other components of
yes.
the fraud there, but several of them were very close to a Ponzi scheme. It was a lack of disclosure of the fact that the funds or the limited partnership interests at issue in that case were substantially intermingled with one another, and that the ability of the earlier limited partnerships to be viable was based in large part on the availability of future income streams from future offerings, Your Honor. And
there is no question in your mind, is there, that if Radin had followed general accepted accounting principles, the financials would not have been reported as certified? That they couldn't have... They
that
relied
correct,
on
Your Honor. That is correct.
There's no question about that.
Yeah, they would either have to not certify the financial statements or in some way disclose what was going on. You know, they could have refused to participate.
No, but my point is they did certify them.
Yes.
And it's impossible to have a Ponzi scheme and certify your financials.
I think it would likely be impossible. I think that's correct, Your Honor. And what I really am concerned about is the prospect, I believe, that it would enable that you could simply allege non-disclosure by simply failing to disclose that someone was perpetuating a fraud. I think it obscures slightly the difference between an instance where an issuer itself is refusing to disclose that it itself is engaging in fraud, and an instance like this where a separate entity is not disclosing that the issuer isn't engaging in fraud. Because if the issuer itself is engaging in fraud, and as Interbank admittedly did here, I think you are much more likely to be faced with an instance where the issuer itself is making misrepresentations, because those will almost always be the source of the fraud. And there's a difference between that and an instance where an auditor is aware of that fraud and fails to disclose it. In that instance, the source of liability for the auditor itself is much more likely to be its failure to disclose the fraud than any affirmative statements it makes, because the source of the fraud itself would be the issuer's fraud, not that by the auditor. So, if you don't have any more questions, Your Honor, I don't have anything more that I really have to say.
Give you time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I'm Michael Martinez, and with me at council table is Shimiso Mazwowi of our firm and Daniel Goldwasser of the Vedder Price firm in New York. Your Honor, the primary issue on appeal here is whether the district court abused its discretion in not permitting the plaintiffs to amend their complaint for at least the seventh time on the grounds that to do so would be futile. And it's important, I just want to cover briefly the history of this case, because the district court was not writing on a clean slate.
Does it matter?
It does matter,
Why?
Your Honor.
Isn't there strictly a legal question here to us now?
Well, it is a strictly a legal question, but I think it's important for you to know that this case, the district court has dismissed this case three times.
It doesn't matter. If the district court was wrong in its decision with respect to whether or not this is an omission primarily or a misrepresentation, then everything else goes out the window.
Well,
there's no point you're going.
All right. Well, it just matters in this way, Your Honor, if I may, and that is that at the end of this, the district court's opinion, the district court states with, I think, some stridency that the court is convinced that the plaintiffs cannot plead a case that relies on reliance. And I say that, and now we're relying on this most recent version of the proposed complaint, and I will get there momentarily, but I say that because the district court judge is not writing on a clean slate. Judge Bates had years of looking at this.
In fact, he was reversed twice by this court, wasn't he?
On very narrow grounds, which is the point I wanted to
make. I'm not suggesting, I have the highest respect for Judge Bates. But the issue here for us doesn't depend on there were seven different complaints. It's strictly a legal question. Is this primarily an omission covered by Ute's presumption or not?
Right.
And
I will get to that now, Your Honor.
My suggestion is it's trying to bring in all the extraneous color is going to be irrelevant.
All right, Your Honor. Well, anyway, this time around, Judge Bates refused to amend the complaint and held that he did so because the plaintiffs had not adequately alleged transaction causation or reliance, a requisite factor in a securities fraud case. Now, as Judge Bates found, the proposed complaint does not allege that the plaintiffs relied upon Radin's misrepresentation or omissions in the various filings by Radin's. In other words, he found it was essentially a mixed case where there were affirmative statements made by Radin in some instances, as alleged in the complaint, and there were omissions otherwise by Radin. Now, the district court went through and analyzed in great detail the statements that the complaint made where Radin made affirmative statements, and analyzed the statements made in the complaint where there were supposedly admissions. And the district court properly found that this was, in essence, a mixed case, but there were the number of affirmative statements made by Radin dwarfed the number of omissions in his reading of it, and that therefore affiliated Ute did not apply.
Isn't it fair to say that all the misrepresentations there encompassed the Ponzi scheme? That is to say, the Ponzi scheme could not exist but for the misrepresentations in the accounting documents?
Well, let me say this, Your Honor. First of all, of course, we assert there was no Ponzi scheme, but obviously you have to take the complaint as alleged for purposes of this. So, no, I don't believe that's fair at all, Your Honor. I think that...
well, that was your argument.
Well,
let me...
You completely...
No. I misunderstood your question.
Like I've never seen.
I misunderstood your question. Your Honor, if you could restate it, I'm sorry.
He was essentially asking you, aren't you right in your argument?
We are right in our argument, right. Yes. I apologize, Your Honor. I misunderstood your question.
Look at the financials that you certified. I'm trying to understand why a Ponzi scheme adds anything but a characterization to the underlying fraud, and that if the plaintiffs are correct, they have alleged that the P&L and balance sheet are false.
The Ponzi scheme doesn't add anything because, Your Honor, essentially, as you noted in your questioning of my opposing counsel, when an accounting firm issues any sort of statement, you know, there may or may not be levels of disclosure or not disclosure that are there. And you could always make the argument that this didn't disclose enough, that it was a Ponzi scheme because you didn't tell us everything. But then this gets to the point that you made earlier, that this brings everything into the context of an omission, and therefore everything would fall within the affiliated
context. I want to make sure I'm not missing something. All Judge Silman is asking you is, aren't the misrepresentations here, in fact, predominant? Because this is about a Ponzi scheme, and the misrepresentations are what hit it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, that's all he's asking you.
All right.
Unless
that's,
I miss something. Correct. Which takes it out of you, is what...
Exactly. And our point is that Judge Bates properly determined this was not an affiliated appropriate case. And it was a correct determination, because the whole purpose of affiliated ute is it's an exception to the general rule that provides that where there are no positive statements made by the defendant, reliance as a practical matter is impossible to prove. Here, the district court judge found that reliance could easily have been asserted by the plaintiffs, and they did not. They had every opportunity to, and they did not do it. And affiliated ute
was the problem, as you know, is that there are always positive statements. So distinguishing these mixed cases, which category falls on which side of the line is?
It's very, very difficult, Judge Kavanaugh. And in fact, Judge Bates pointed that out. He said, look, I've got these statements on one side. I've got Radin's on the others. It is very difficult to try and parse through that. And he cited the Joseph case from the Tenth Circuit in support of that statement and said, you know, when you take all this together, you got to look at the underlying purpose of affiliated ute, and it doesn't fit here.
Seems that a lot of courts over time are narrowing affiliated ute to a very small section of the
right.
of the law.
Not the district courts.
Not all, many.
I believe that's right. And so our view obviously is that Judge Bates properly.
It may be right, but is it proper?
I believe it is proper because, one could say that the law in these securities fraud cases is getting narrower and narrower and harder for plaintiffs to prove, but it is what the law is, and they could well have asserted detrimental reliance or causation based on this complaint, but they did not do so, and they've had multiple opportunities to amend their complaint and have not met this prong of what you need to meet for a Section 10 case. So, Your Honor, unless you have any further questions, we'd rely on our briefs and believe that Judge Bates should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, unless you have any further questions for me, I don't have any rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.